Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a deadly conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Deadly, as in drug use, can be deadly. There's a fine line between a medication being therapeutic and helpful versus taking too much and it becoming deadly. We learned that with the prescription opioid epidemic. At the time, the country was dealing with 100 deaths a day, a crazy amount of people. And it took a while for parent victims of opioid prescriptions to unite and demand action. Much of the blame was placed on the medical and pharmaceutical communities, the suppliers of opioids. In 2015 and 2017, I studied every single death in San Diego County that was caused by a medication. I wanted to really understand where I and my profession was going wrong. The research changed my life as a physician and guides my prescribing practices to this day. The studies demonstrated which medications and combination of medications are killers and the fine line of a chemical being therapeutic versus a poison. Learning from this science and working on the supply, we ended the opioid prescription crisis. Things aren't perfect, but prescription opioid deaths are no longer an epidemic. Sadly, we now have a worse epidemic, the fentanyl crisis, that's even more deadly. Today, we have 300 deaths a day from drugs, three times as the, quote, good old days when I first studied the opioid problem. It's worse than crazy. We're being attacked. Fentanyl is the number one killer of Americans age 18 to 45. For fentanyl, like any chemical, there's a fine line between therapeutics and poisoning. I use fentanyl in the hospital in dosages measured in micrograms. Illicit fentanyl is measured in milligrams. That's a 1,000-fold difference. And that's why we say 2 grains of fentanyl can kill. Fentanyl is not just killing people who have a substance use disorder. It's also killing people without an addiction who make a mistake, a deadly mistake, and it's not fair. What can we learn from prescription opioid deaths that applies to the current fentanyl crisis? To learn more about preventing deaths, I reach out to Mary Bono. Mary Bono is a well-known political community and business leader who served as Congresswoman for California in 1998. She wrote legislation signed by Presidents Bush, Clinton, and Obama. She's widely recognized as a leader on multiple issues, including the issue of drugs. She co-created the first Prescription Drug Abuse Caucus and chaired hearings specific to the opioid epidemic. She currently serves as the chair of the board of Mothers Against Prescription Drug Abuse. She also hosts her own popular podcast, Sagely Speaking. To learn more about Mary Bono, check out the High Truths show notes. Mary Bono, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you. Nice to see you. It's been way too long.
I know. It has been a while. I mean, I think last we were talking at a Scripps conference about prescription opioids, and I remember Aaron Rubin was there in his wheelchair. And I think we got a hold of the prescription drug problem, but now we still have worse problems.
You know, it's so funny, Ronit. When we started this work, and even way back when, I think we felt we were making a difference and turning things around. Statistics were improving. And then along comes fentanyl and the big fentanyl and synthetic opioid problem, which was a game changer for sure. And has made our work so much harder in so many areas.
Right. And you've been really, you know, a legend in working on this issue now for many years in the community and in legislative process. How did you come to this path out of all the things that you're working on? to the issue of drugs?
You know, my family was touched by this personally. My family's been touched by addiction forever. But specific with the prescription drug epidemic, we were hit hard. Not as hard as others. However, we were hit, and we spoke publicly about it in about 2007. And I was a sitting member of Congress at the time, and it was very clear to me that we were watching the makings of a national nightmare in the fact that prescription drug companies, manufacturers, they knew what was happening, but rather than curtailing the abuse and the diversion and the youth, use, they were doubling down. It was their profit model. And so we were watching that unfold, and I really felt we needed to do everything we could to put this genie back in the box. And again, talk about whether at that time it was the pill mills in Florida. You know, we used to say that if you had a dozen dolphins wash up on the shores of Florida, there would be such a public outcry. But if you have a dozen kids die of an overdose, you don't hear about it.
I love your dolphin analogy. You're famous for that. And it's so true. We would be so outraged if there was like two dolphins die outside our shores. And if there's, 300 people a day dying from drugs, it's accepted.
You know, and these are preventable deaths. You know, not all. I I'm not going to be Pollyannish. I'm not going to be naive. They are not all preventable. And that's a sad, sad truth. But a large number of them are preventable. A large number of these addictions are preventable. A large number of the overdose deaths are preventable. And certainly a large number of these fentanyl poisonings are preventable if we would enact the right policies. And if people would wake up and pay attention, this isn't something that's only going to happen to your neighbor or somebody else's problem. This is hitting home in every single household in America in one way or another now. But people still seem to think it's not going to happen to them until it's too late, and it has.
Right, right. If you don't mind, I want to just pay tribute to the memory of Sonny Bono. I'm a big fan of his music and proud of his political leadership. And I recall his ski accident where he died as if it was yesterday. Oh. And I'm sure it was a changing point in your life as well.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are times in our lives, maybe not all of us, but where your life is completely turned upside down in an instant. You don't plan for it. You don't know what you're going to do. You certainly weren't prepared, and you have to make do. And Sonny's death was an accident. It was instantaneous. My kids were 6 and 9 at the time. And I never thought for a moment about being a 36-year-old widow with 2 small children. So I had to figure things out pretty quickly. And obviously when your mom in a situation like that, or any parent, I guess, you know, you have to do what you have to do for the kids and stay strong for the kids. And that's number one. But soon after Sonny died, I was encouraged to run for Congress and run for a seat. And I did.
Fit into his shoes, or was it not trying to fit in his shoes, just making your own way?
That's a great question. I had to be sure I could do both. You know, Sonny had a limited agenda in his congressional career, and it was going to be enacted soon or not. I needed to know that I would have my own agenda and be able to stand on what I believed in and fight for my constituents in my way. And I felt that I could do that. And luckily I had fantastic support from my family, from others, supporters, national leaders. Gerald Ford was my campaign manager. Betty wow. Ford was also campaign chairman. And when President Ford passed, Betty Ford became my campaign chairman. So I had great support and people who believed in me. And I remember early on saying to a politician that I didn't want to run for office because the last thing I wanted to do was to tell people how to live their lives. And his response was, then you're perfect. You're perfect. You should do this. But, I lasted for 15 years in office. And it was a better time when I served than it is today. I hate to say, I think people were more cordial to a large degree. We were more willing to work together. But, 15 years I served.
That's great. And you're a Republican woman. And there have been other Republican women who face cancel culture because of their beliefs, because of their politics. Do you see that still happening? Did that happen to you?
Oh, it did happen to me. And I did. I served as a Republican. I'm now an independent. To tell you the truth, both parties let me down. So I'm an independent. I'm a wait and see, and let's see what unfolds in the campaign season. But yes, it happened to me. But I don't know that it only happened to me because I'm a Republican or served as a Republican. I really don't. I got sideways with Simone Biles over a tweet that I had done. For the record, she and I reconciled. We had a fantastic meeting. We talked through what had happened and let it go. We both agreed there's no way to undo what had been done. So let's just move on. And so it happened. I think it happens to all of us every day in one form or another in our lives these days, especially with social media. Cancel culture is just bullying on large scale. But you look at what our children are faced with now on small scale with social media and the social media ills that are thrust upon them, whether it's shaming, teasing, taunting, whatever it is, it's the same thing. It's the unhealthy culture that social media has brought upon us. And unfortunately, the mainstream media seems to sort of be victim of as well, because they're dying for ratings. So they have to buy into the same clickbait mentality. So it's a difficult time. And that's why I think it's really important that parents instill strong values in their kids, that give them a strong foundation. They understand how to be strong through all sorts of this adversity, whether it's cancel culture or bullying. It's unfortunately commonplace.
Yeah. You worked on a lot of legislative issues that were signed by Presidents Clinton, Bush, Obama. Are there any that stand out to you as like your proudest accomplishments?
Well, yes. And it, as far as the issue itself goes, it's not the largest. But the way in which we did this legislation, and I say we because I, together with my staff, we did some environmental policy. We created a national monument using the congressional way rather than the executive order. And we took time to do this. I hiked the land. I rode it on horseback. I camped in it. I met with my ranchers. I met with my builders. I met with my environmentalists. I brought everybody to the same table. And it was amazing what happens when you do that. When you do that repeatedly with people, they begin to understand each other and talk to each other and to understand that the other side's point of view isn't evil. It's just different. And I think the more you try to do that and bring people together, the more you can find consensus. And we did. We drafted a bill, got it signed into law by President Clinton, ironically on my birthday. I don't know that he knew that he signed it on my birthday, but he did. And to this day, it's heralded as the way to do environmental policy. Now, a lot of people, especially in this day and age, wouldn't have the desire to sit down with the other side, say, let's call them the other side, because they would rather have the talking points and the frustrations, and they would rather beat up on the other guy rather than saying, wait a minute, I see your point. Let's talk about how we can get some of what you want, some of what the other guys need, and is there a way to find common ground? And that's what we did. And I am extraordinarily proud of that. I'm very proud that we did 3 days on horseback. I took my staff up there, a couple of them, they'd never ridden a horse before. And it was a very difficult ride. And there were some fun moments. Nobody got hurt, but I think two fell off the horses. let's see. They're all stronger for it. In any event, it was fantastic. And it's the way it ought to be, I think.
Wow. What a great team building experience too.
Yeah.
I love that consensus, bringing people together. That used to be the art of a legislator now. And I think you're right. Sadly, at least, from the public's eye, it seems that, the world is, black or white. And that's how things are pushed instead of the fact, the science that the world is mostly gray, right? It's not so extreme.
I'm glad you've said that, because I've been wrestling with this very thing this week. And I know this podcast is evergreen, so I won't define what this week is necessarily, but in political discussion right now, people more often believe the world is black and white, and that solutions are black and white, and that the other guy is wrong. That's the way. And with politics, everybody believes that their opinion is the right one, period, the end. And it's so unfortunate that you can't realize, you know, this person's not evil. I mean, clearly there are bad people in the world, but somebody's not evil just because we disagree on how to achieve something. Look, in our world, in the drug policy world, you know, I'm not a harm reductionist. I believe in prevention. But I respect the work that harm reductionists do out there on the streets and what they do. And, you know, do I believe it's going to be as effective in the long term? No. But, you know, my heart is my heart, and I'm going to do what I believe is right. And it's just so sad. The other thing, you know, Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, none of them are clamoring for that good old pragmatic moderate to get on there to talk about how they're hammering away at a deal. They want the people to get up there who are going to enrage the endorphins.
Right. Right? Exactly right. If you're a moderate, like, you don't get as many clicks if you say, hey, there's truth to both sides, that you don't get clicks for that. You get clicks and you get ratings for what's inflaming.
Right. You know, when you think about it, people don't drive by and watch people engaged in honest, thoughtful conversation. But if they drive by and they see a fight going on, they're going to stop and take notice and think that that's interesting. And it's really unfortunate. I hope we get back to the days of thought. And again, you look at, in this day and age, if something happens, a major event happens, you know, the Twitterverse or Xverse, whatever you want to call it, is going to light up instantly with information and misinformation. They're going to line up with opinions. They're going to come out with a statement. For some reason, even, say, CNN will have to come out with a statement that, had they waited 30 seconds longer, would have been closer to the truth than having to come out immediately with something, having to have this reaction. And we're removing thought from the world. We're just removing the ability to stop and think. Right. Because we have to react first.
Or the truth, or just, you just want to get to the, okay, well, what's really happening? What is to getting there? You know, you were talking about preventionist, harm reductionist. Let's take that further. I think things are difficult because it's all good. And I mean, I'm a doctor, so I don't consider myself a harm reductionist or prevention or treatment. I do also, as an ER doctor, I treat people. That's what I do. Who have the worst addictions, you know, was driven, you know, from our prescription epidemic problem to study addiction medicine and become board certified in that as well. But if I take the whole, if I want to learn from history, and I want to take a methodical way to, I want to solve this problem, then I learned, how did we do it with tobacco? How did we do it with opioid prescriptions? We did that. We did not arrest our way out of it. We didn't treat our way out of it. We didn't naloxone or buprenorphine our way out of it. It was really getting at the front end of the supply chain by preventing in the next generation of becoming addicted to opioid prescriptions. That's what drove the needle down. And what I see us doing now with fentanyl is spending more and more billions of dollars, but we're not moving the needle. And why is that? And I think it's, if you take the entire population of the United States and look at people who really need harm reduction services, it's a small percentage, but they're getting most of the billions of dollars. But what's being done, you know, fentanyl testing strips, needle exchange, naloxone, you know, that's important. That's science. That's helping those people stay alive. Nobody's against that. But we're putting all our efforts there, all the billions of dollars there, and it, at the cost of prevention. And that's going to be a failed formula. We're going to continue to have a problem. If we want to make the next generation not go to fentanyl or drugs, we have to go upstream and go in prevention. That doesn't mean we don't do any treatment or harm reduction, but the effort, we have to keep that small part of the population alive, but we have to go through the entire American population with prevention strategies in order to prevent the problem for the next generation.
You know, just a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, naloxone or any opioid overdose or overdose reversal medication, excuse me, it's a mouthful. It's beyond safe use. It's beyond harm reduction. It with fentanyl poisonings, with, you know, coming across somebody else who might be overdosing, somebody who had an accidental exposure, it's so much further than just harm reduction. It is preventing a death. And I think that's important to keep that in mind, because I'm encouraging parents of even high school students to equip their kids to right. carry something in case they see somebody else. And right. I think that's important.
In your glove box, keep it. I mean, we used to have like Ipecac in the olden days for poison, you know, for poisoning. We need to have, everybody should have naloxone in their house.
Right. I actually believe that kids should not be allowed, if it's in their backpack, this should be no big deal. If simply naloxone is in a backpack, it should be fine. But, and I fought for that. But the other thing is where we're missing the point. I strongly believe this. And the rhetoric against those of us who believe in prevention and actually believe in a drug-free life, oh, the war on drugs failed. It was a failure, all of this stuff. The truth of the matter is, it has changed dramatically. And the international narco-trafficking cartels who are profiting in the billions of dollars off of the health of our children ought to be a war on drugs. I agree. You cannot incarcerate your way out of this. You're not going to take somebody who's got an active addiction and, you know, and put them in jail. Necessarily, some people will get clean and sober or decide to get out and become clean and sober. But I agree, you know, it's treatment, not incarceration for people who suffer from addiction. However, this is a war for our children. And these are people who are intentionally targeting our children. And now they're using social media. They're using Snapchat to target our kids, to sell them drugs. And they come up with any story that they can to sell them this poison. If they see a bunch of, you know, young high school football players, they'll change the story to, if you take these drugs, you'll build more muscle. And that's a true story that happened in a California example. They told this kid, you know, if you take this drug, you'll build muscle because you won't feel as much pain when you work out. And that pill was laced with fentanyl. So this war on drugs, it ought to be, we need war on drug dealers. We need a war on the cartels. We need a war on, you know, these Chinese precursors. How we can lose, you know, over 100, it depends on which statistic you want to look at. But over 100 people a day, 120, some will say higher than that. You and I talked about the dolphin example. How we can lay down our arms and say this is okay is beyond me, especially when a 12-year-old child simply thinks this is harmless and will help their life or help ease their anxiety or help them fit in if they get this pill off of Snapchat. And how we do not throw everything we have at that, I don't know.
The word war has gotten like a bad connotation, but I agree with you. I mean, I don't mind call it war. I feel like I use that analogy. I feel like we're being attacked. Our country's under attack. If you have 300 people die a day from drugs, we're under attack. And these are not all people who have a substance use disorder. They're people who make a mistake, or babies who run into something and crawl on the floor where there was fentanyl and drop dead. So I think that we are under attack. And actually, I'd like to get your take on it. I work with families against fentanyl, and we want fentanyl to be declared a weapon of mass destruction in order to go upstream on the supply.
I was one of the early signatories onto that letter supporting that very early on. So I proudly stand for that. Look, fentanyl has been weaponized before. It has been proven to be a weapon of mass destruction. It was used effectively by the Russians against the Chechens, I believe, if memory is serving me correctly. So it is. And, you know, it doesn't take a brilliant mind. It takes a reasonable mind to go, this is really, would be simple to have happen here. When you look at how small, teeny tiny, minuscule amount of fentanyl is needed to kill somebody. So that's Jim, our friend Jim's effort, and I completely support him. And I think people need to wake up to recognize that this is a real threat. Look, after 9/11, we went through this with anthrax and the threat that anthrax posed. So these are not that far-fetched of scenarios that could possibly happen. And, you know, unfortunately, the government was asleep for so long when fentanyl was coming in through the U.S. Postal Service. And other commercial shipping companies were just importing it, bringing it in, and kids were, you know, bad guys were breaking it up and selling it. So we really lost a lot of time there. But Ronnie, I got to tell you, it doesn't seem that unusual for the government to be so slow to react to these sorts of things. And it's very frustrating.
Yeah. Jim Rao, who's founder of Families Against Fentanyl, that's the friend that is getting a shout out here. And he actually got to be observe an EMS training, a disaster medicine training, where they actually took drones and aerosolized what was pretend fentanyl and did like a mock event at a stadium where people were dropping from fentanyl. I actually did a podcast with the physician who directed that. And I said, okay, well, how do you prepare? And he goes, you can't really prepare. You have to prevent. Because if something like that happens, people will die. So it's best to prevent and deter because there's no way to 100%, you know, to be able to deal with it.
But I think prevent, deter, and prepare, because I think it's a possibility, again, whether it's, we again, after 9/11, it was anthrax was the scare, and now fentanyl and how easy it is to smuggle it in and to have it. You know, these are just tough times. And, you know, my podcast, Sagely Speaking, I've had a lot of people talk about the future and what does it look like and what drugs are out there, and what drugs are coming down the pike. And it does seem that the minute we innovate and we get something like fentanyl test strips, we get Narcan, we get things that are responses, then something new is thrust upon us, like Trank. Again, and now you're looking at meth, the resurgence of methamphetamine again and cocaine again, and it's definitely whack-a-mole. It's just so yeah, I think that innovation is
you're right, we're always a step behind
at least one.
But we also we're giving our children mixed messages, right? We're I would say the marijuana culture. So back when we were dealing with prescription opioids, people who died invariably started with an oxycodone or a hydrocodone who died. But now if I ask my patients who are overdosing on fentanyl, what's the first drug you ever use? It's invariably marijuana. And that is being pushed on our kids in our society, priming the brain on dopamine at a young age. So I wonder if we have some culpability on that as well.
Oh, 100,000%, if there's such a thing. Absolutely we do. And we've taken things out of, boy, I'm going down all sorts of rabbit holes. We've taken things out of the school that used to give us pathways to coping. PE, yes. Art, music. We used to have ways, and we used to, you know, I think have a lot more to build our self-esteem, or I don't know, I hate to say times were easier. I'm sounding so old when I say such a thing, but there were coping mechanisms. And now the coping mechanisms is reach for this. Look, it's not just marijuana. I generally don't pick fights with the marijuana crowd because my beef was prescription drugs and now fentanyl and that the illicit supply and how preventable that is. However, I'm a huge believer in doing what we can to bolster our mental health. For me, that's things like exercise, hiking, you know, I paint, I do all sorts of things, but we're not teaching our children necessarily to do that. And I do believe models are coming back. People are realizing the importance of having kids fully engaged in activities outside of school that keeps them, you know, giving them these pathways to good mental health. But the thing with marijuana, if I'm going to pick a little beef, I've seen it, I've read it, and I know you know this, but the psychoses and the latent psychoses that it can bring out, it is not some harmful, inert, fun little, you know, drug you take to just feel a little bit better. I mean, you really are playing with your own health. And I just don't understand that. But I'm a weirdo. I and my little nonprofit, we say we're just a bunch of squares because we just don't believe in doing drugs. And we believe in, again, if you're having a bad day, go for a hike.
But it, you know what? It seems like that's a square, and the people who, you know, are not using drugs are like quiet or silenced because it seems like everybody else is doing that. But the social norm is not to use drugs. And there are more and more kids who are making the choice to protect their brain and not use alcohol, marijuana, or any type of drugs at least till age 25 to protect their brain. So it seems like, especially if you're working in the issue of, you know, treatment, prevention, and you're talking about drugs, that it's such a problem. And it is such a problem. We have to remember when we talk to kids that the social norm is not to do that.
Well, whatever we're doing right, we need to do more of.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. And, you know, Dr. DuPont will be the first to tell you that fewer and fewer kids or school age kids are choosing to use drugs, high school kids. That's what the data will say. But we ought to be doing more of whatever we're doing there. But the messaging on, look, let me tell you, my congressional district represented Coachella and the Coachella Festival and the Stagecoach Festival, wonderful, huge music festivals. But you'll hear adults our age saying, oh, I'm just going to take some mushrooms in with me and go to the concert and have a great time. And so the fact that it's becoming normalized, I think, is reality. These are professionals. I mean, if that's what they want to do, they're adults, I guess, go to it.
Yeah, but they have to. I don't know if they're making a completely informed decision, because I worked in the emergency department over Christmas, where there was a huge festival at the Padres Stadium, and we just had the ambulance bringing us people in from psychosis. And one, they don't know what they're buying. They're told that they're getting mushrooms, but they don't know what other carcinogens are in there. And I treated one guy with a seizure, and he woke up and he was like, he's never going to do that again. So I don't know, as long as it's informed decision and away from children.
Well, again, don't get me. I wouldn't choose to hang out with somebody. Again, I know a lot of your podcast listeners would probably send me hate mail because they wouldn't want to hang out with me anyway, but I don't think I would enjoy somebody hanging out with somebody who is doing that. I just, it freaks me out. I'll just put it bluntly. It freaks me out.
Well, you should be, because people have really bad reactions and you can't predict what that is. But I think it does go back to what you started saying about, you know, art and hiking and other things. There are ways to enjoy life. There's ways of resiliency, because life is hard and we get our share of things. Nothing is perfect. How are you going to deal with these adversities without going to drugs? How can you enjoy life without using these things? And understand that, again, addiction for profit kind of industry.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's the sad truth is marijuana. I mean, it's all for profit now. And as you've said, we came so far with tobacco. I'm not a fan of tobacco at all. And we had some success there, and then we repeat the whole thing again. Right. But back to, you know, the addiction and hanging out with somebody who is using or is high, it's people change, right? The nature of your conversation, the nature of your interactions change. Everything changes. We all know that. We've all been around somebody who's drunk or loaded or something at some point in time, and the whole relationship changes. And it makes it very complicated to actually have a true, honest, and authentic relationship with somebody when they're not necessarily on the same wavelength you're on, if you will, to put it that way. And I know I am, again, Pollyannish here. I believe in health and doing what you can to guard your health. And this makes sense to me. I don't understand, you know, the people who believe in legalization of all drugs. It's an argument I can't even have, because I don't believe in it. And I'm not going to waste my time on processing it. But they will say, well, if it were legal, if the mushrooms, psilocybin, was legal, then it would be regulated and you would know what you're getting. Okay.
Same thing with marijuana. If that was true, but we've had now how many years of marijuana legalization, and those promised regulations never happened, right? So if you go to any legal pot shop now and buy product, you will get E. coli, aspergillus, and various contaminants and toxins. It's just part of that. And all the promised regulations didn't happen, right? Our kids are not protected. There's more kids getting poisoned from marijuana now. And these are babies under the age of 5. They don't have an addiction. So those, you know, if those promised regulations were there, we would, you know, we'd have something to talk about it, but that never happened.
Well, let's say they did. Let's say the FDA was doubled in size and they could regulate and oversee and do everything the FDA is supposed to do. But more kids died from regulated prescription drugs or got addicted or got, you know, their lives were changed forever from legal, regulated products. That's not a safeguard.
Right. You're right. It's more of a balance, trying to get a balance with the public, want for marijuana, just for marijuana, for legalizing all drugs. That's a bigger red line, because we do have a duty as a society for public health protections, right? We have seat belts, we have speed limits, we have rules that protect the public. It does infringe on your freedom rights, but sometimes we do that when there's a big enough red line for public health protection. So we do that with car safety and other things, and I think we have an obligation to do that with hard drugs.
Again, regulating illicit drugs, I think, is a little bit out there, but I think that the FDA, the number of federal entities alone with a piece of the public safety from the drug supply, it's big. And we failed. We simply failed. And it took so long for them to wake up to the pill mills. And look, you and I both know, because we've been doing this and we've been friends a while, the drag is not the hundreds of thousands we've lost. It's the next 5,000, 10,000 we're going to meet.
That's why we do what we're doing, right?
It's where we're failing. And I'm hopeful that the next administration, whoever it is, but takes things up a notch here. Parents really need help. I mean, we can extend this into vaping too, right? But parents need some help here. It's impossible for a parent to catch everything, especially for the rebellious young years that our kids go through, but they definitely need help. And again, the narco traffickers, the cartels, when we were kids, here I go again, sounding like a Grammy, which I am, but the drug dealer was some guy down on the street, and now it is a part of a big transnational criminal organization. And it is very, very, very sophisticated. And we just need to step up against that and recognize, and it doesn't take a huge, again, brilliant mind to go, they're going to get more power. They're going to get stronger. What is next? Like, it's drugs, it's human smuggling, weapons smuggling. Who knows what is next? But the longer we get them, we allow them to get stronger, the more dangerous things become.
Yeah. We kind of have a supply chain from, China and Mexico and drug cartels. And then we also have our internal American market of, marijuana, candies, and fancy vape products and mushrooms and all that. That's also taken into it. Your podcast, Shazely Speaking. You enjoy that? I love this podcast. I get to, that's an excuse to talk to you again.
I do love it, Ronnie. When we started it, I was persuaded to do it by a couple of friends. And I said, okay, but I don't want to just talk about the drug problem, because I'd like to talk about some positive, uplifting things and move beyond this. And we thought, okay, let's, for 1 year, let's just talk about the drug problems. Well, our 1 year, we're booked. I know, just like you are, we're booked solid with speakers because the problem is that big. So every once in a while, I'm wedging in a little interview with somebody that is a departure from just the drug topic, because I'm trying to weave in other mental health, aids. And I interviewed a guy who's the COO of a pet food company, Lucy Pet Foods. And he was talking to me about all in on how important owning a pet can be for your mental health. And it's like, let's talk about this, because it's true. Not only our mental health, but our physical health. So I have a pet food. I interviewed my husband, who's a former astronaut. That was fun. And I did my golf pro.
I have to tell you, I listened to the one where you interviewed your husband, and I thought that was my favorite, because I actually tried to get my husband's a dentist, and I thought, I should get him to talk about meth mouth. And explain that, or try to get my son. And he said he was going to do it for me. And I even kind of helped him with the little script. And then he came to that and he was like, he just froze. He couldn't do it.
Doesn't he know you own the record and the edit button too?
No, he's just not a public speaker at all. He's in people's mouths all day long. He just could not. He could not talk on the microphone. I think I got him as close to the microphone, but like he just like, he was like, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's too bad. I bet he'd be fascinating once you got him going.
Yeah.
But it is fun. It's a lot of work to have a podcast, as you know, and you have to show up and be prepared and have your gear working. And but I love it. I do love it. I love whether 5 people listen to my voice or 500 listen to my voice, it's my voice. And I try to say what I think and I mean. And I try to spread some happiness and joy and ultimately, hopefully, some good things. I think we all need more of that. If you go into social media now, Ronit, I think within 30 seconds, you'll be confronted with hate.
Yeah, I know. I stay away from it. And it's a hard because I can't promote my podcast, but it's not a good feeling. I don't like, it's not to do that.
No, you're right. It's not a good feeling.
And it's a different type of addiction, right? You get into that. My husband and son went on an NN diet. Do you know what an NN diet is?
I do not.
They went on a no news diet and they were like better human beings for it. So yeah, that's true.
I think that's a great concept. Even if you go off the grid for a week and let your mind declutter and get it unaddicted to the need to check your devices. And look, I am guilty. I am as guilty of that as the next one. I don't know how often, every 45 seconds, I have that impulse to check. What texts come in, what emails come in, I am guilty. And I know that I could benefit from getting off that grid for a little while.
Yeah. They did really well. And then I came in and I said, the president was shot and they were like right on their phone.
To get all that misinformation. I mean, how quick was it? The president was shot. Oh, okay. It was a setup. It was fake. It was planted. I mean, and this is important, the amount of anxiety that this puts into the American psyche and all of these unknowns and misinformation and too much information. I think it's just really unhealthy.
Yeah. Just the facts, what we need to know. And doing that, sagely speaking, I love it, and I'm glad you're enjoying the podcast. I'm enjoying listening to your news, and you know, final words. What do we need to do if you were the drug czar, or you were the president? What would you be doing next administration, Dave Bunn? What needs to happen?
Well, thank you for asking, and I'll speak off the top of my head, not knowing exactly what I would do, but I would start with going after narco traffickers. I would gain international support. Look, this is now exported. It's no longer just a U.S. problem. It's happening around the world. And I would gain international support to go after these drug traffickers, these narco traffickers, the people who are, you know, preying on our citizens and our kids. I would take a very serious hardline approach there, for starters. Secondly, I would talk about the importance of prevention and mental health, and I would bring back more programs into schools, although I don't know how I would do that, but again, that help with mental health and coping. And, you know, that's a start, but I would focus on prevention. I would have conversations about the importance of telling your loved ones not to dabble in these drugs, that they're very dangerous. I would go after the cartels and their funding sources. I would freeze their money. I would really do everything I could to take out the worst of the worst bad guys. And then I would focus on prevention. I would focus on diversion, prevention. Look, there is a time and a place for opioids. I get it. I wholeheartedly agree. You know, as an ER doc, better than I do. That's true. We need them. They're an important part of managing pain. But the government, we ought to be doing a much better job on keeping those pain pills out of the hands of our kids. And, you know, for far too long, we turned the other way. So I wouldn't allow that to happen anymore. And I would make sure that the corporations who are involved, you know, raise their own bar on what they would allow to happen, because they all knew what was happening on their watches. So that's it in my
not opioids from doing the research, probably in benzodiazepines too, and you know, other drugs that are being abused.
Correct. You're right. Yes, the same problem, especially when it's corporate, you know, profit at the end of it all. And that's not the point of the drug company. So I would do that. And then I would hire you as my sidekick. But I have no desire to go back to Washington, D.C. I'm going to keep doing my podcasts and do what I do, you know, at my level. And my son always asks me, Mom, why do you do this? And
how old is he?
36. He's 36 with his master's in psychology. And that's probably says, Mom, why do you do this? And it's simple because it's a lot of it's fixable. A lot of it's fixable and preventable if we just roll up our sleeves and do it and are serious about it. That's why I do it.
Yeah. And you're a leader and you're an advocate and you see results by your words and your actions and your organization. So that's rewarding. And I think you've taken all the years, you know, on a federal level, you don't need to go back to DC. You have that knowledge and be actually more effective from the outside.
Well, thank you. I'd like to think so, but being in office was, as you know, a demanding career like yours, and it takes a toll on your family. And I don't want my family to take a toll on my family again. I want to be able to focus more on my family than I was able to when I was in office. I think that's very important for my life now.
Awesome. So good mental health, and then that makes you productive and happy, and that's sagely speaking.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.